We spend some time now with the man who was the driving force behind WGN Radio Sports for some four decades, more than four decades, the longtime sports editor of WGN going back to 1954, and a good friend, Jack Rosenberg. Jack, more than 40 years of sports, of Chicago sports, you have always been a walking encyclopedia of Chicago sports. I don't know exactly where to begin, but why don't we start with your arrival in Chicago. You came from Peoria. You were writing sports in Peoria, right? And then how'd you end up at WGN?
I was with the Peoria Journal Star at that point and had met Jack Brickhouse at a couple of sports dinners. And I always wanted to work for the Tribune Company. Some years into my time in Peoria, through the goodness of Jack and Kenny Jones, who was sports editor of the Peoria Journal, they arranged an interview for me with Arch Ward, who was the greatest sports editor in the world, Chicago Tribune. And I wind up as a kid out of Peoria in that big office on the fourth floor with the glass windows and all. And here I am being interviewed by Arch Ward, and we talk for an hour, and he said, "I'm impressed with what I hear, not only from you, but from your friends in Peoria." And he says, "I have a job for you with the Tribune, Tribune Sports." And he says, "I can start you in 3 weeks." And I said, "Mr. Ward, I just cannot believe that this is happening," because I had written a theme in the fifth grade in Pekin, where I was born and reared. And the theme was, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" And I said, "I want to work for the Chicago Tribune Sports Department." And I said, "Here I am years later in your office." And I said, "This is unbelievable to me." He said, "Well, I have the job for you at $100 a week, starting in 3 weeks." And he looked at me, and he said, "Is there a problem?" And I said, "Yes, sir. I'm making $110 in Peoria." He says, "You are?" He says, "Well," I said, I've won 2 national awards from the NCAA for sports writing covering Bradley University. And I said, "The newspaper has been very kind to me down there." And I said, I don't know what to tell you, but my mother is widowed. And I said, "I am single, but I want to bring her to Chicago with me. And I think you know that $10 means a lot to me." He said, "I understand that." But he says, "Let me tell you something." He said, "I once had the same problem." And he says, "I came here from Rockford." And he said, "I was here for a little while, and I got to thinking, I don't know if the money is right, and the newspaper is very big. I think maybe I want to go back to Rockford." And he said, "Just when that was happening, going through my mind, I get a call from Don Maxwell, who called me into his office and said that he had just been promoted from sports editor to managing editor of the Chicago Tribune, and that he wanted me to become the sports editor with this great, great 42-man sports department, biggest in the world." And he said, "So, I was in the right place when the lightning struck." He said, "I get the feeling you will be too." And he said, "Starting salary is beside the point." He said, "You see that man out there?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Used to be Philadelphia Inquirer, $100 a week when he came here. See that man over here? St. Louis Globe Democrat." He said, $100 a week. On and on. He said, "You go back and think it over." And he says, "Let me know," because he said, "We start everybody at the same salary." So I go back to Peoria, most agonizing time I've ever had on a train ride back to Peoria, thinking, here's the job of my dreams, and I cannot handle it. I wrote him back a letter, told him how flattered I was, turned it down. He later wrote me a registered letter. Now, when you're a kid in Peoria, kid newspaper man, and you get a registered letter from the Chicago Tribune, you have to sign for it. And he said that he understood my position. And he said he admired my loyalty to my newspaper and to my mother. And he said in my case, he was going to try to make an exception. But he didn't want anybody else to know about it, and he needed 3 months to work out the details. Well, that was like praise from Caesar. And in the meantime, while I was waiting for Mr. Ward to call me, Jack Brickhouse calls one day and said, hey, kid, I know you want to be with the Tribune Company. And he says, I have a job with me here in television and radio at WGN. He said, it's the Tribune Company, as you know. And he said, I'd like to have you come up and join me in the sports department here. And I said, Mr. Brickhouse, I have never been around radio or television. I'm a newspaper man. He said, we know all about you. And he said, why don't you come up to Wilmette and at least talk with me at my home, and let's see what we can put together. So he had to tell me how to get to Wilmette. And I got up there, and Jack and I talked for 2-3 hours. And to make a long story short, which I have not done, 3 weeks later, I was working for the Tribune Company, except instead of working for the paper itself, I was working for GN Radio and GN Television. And instead of getting $100 a week, I was getting $85 a week because Jack gave me the same story, telling me it wasn't the starting salary, it was being in the right place when the lightning struck, and the rest is history. I stayed, and it's the best move I ever made.
A lot of people looked at broadcasting as being sort of the ugly stepchild to print journalism. I know a lot of sports writers over the years have looked they've looked sideways at broadcasters. As a sports writer, how did you feel about leaving print journalism and moving into radio?
It was a big change for me, Dave. I thought about it a lot because I always had wanted to write, but I was in a unique position because the way Jack outlined it, I also was going to do my share of writing, and he also promised to introduce me to the then editor of the Sunday Tribune magazine section, so that I sort of had the best of both worlds. For some years, I wrote features for the Tribune magazine. So there was a difference. I think the newspaper fraternity always looked askance at people in radio and television, and I think probably to this day there's still some question as to whether, as far as accuracy and the down and dirty parts of reporting, are not handled better by newspaper people. And I really cannot answer that. I think it depends on the person himself or herself, and I would let it go at that.
People always think about WGN Radio. They think about the long relationship with the Cubs and the long relationship with the Bears. When you came to WGN, what sports properties did the station have, and what were your responsibilities when you first came here?
When I first came here, my responsibilities were to accompany the sports people, namely Jack Brickhouse, Vince Lloyd — Lou Boudreau was not here yet — And my job was to not only put together and write and produce the sports shows that they did, radio and television, but also to go to the ballpark and hang around. And I would be in the dugouts, I'd be in the clubhouses. I got so I knew everyone's name, and I would pick up the human interest items, which I had done for years as a newspaper man, except now I was translating that ability and using it for the television or the radio. And for most of my years, I spent in a television booth, but right next to the radio booth, so we were all in cahoots with one another. And I would pick up items. Statistics were given to us, as you people know. They were given to us by the Cubs media relations people, but I was looking for the extra things that someone had that you couldn't find in the books or would not get in a statistical sheet. And I was with broadcasters who were so good that they could take a one-line or a two-line item that I gave them, and you never would realize that they'd been written and given to them. Although as time went along, I was to understand later that a lot of people started listening for my typewriter. So my typewriter became famous of in itself. But that was the thing. But we did it for years and years and years and years. And literally, as you know, Dave, we came down the road together. We covered at WGN, being a part of this, you know, as I look back now, it's been so rewarding to be affiliated with WGN Radio and Television and the Chicago Tribune. Means the world and all to me. We covered the broad spectrum of life. We worked together. We socialized together. You had the great people that I was identified with, and Jack Brickhouse and Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau and all the rest. We took part in all the things that life brings together. I mean, we had the marriages and the graduations and the religious events, unfortunately, the funerals. We covered them all and came down the road together. And I can't tell you, even as I reflect now, and I'm very flattered that you people would have me down here again after all these years, because I spent 45 years with the company. And as I look back now and to come into WGN Radio Studios and see so many people that I knew through the years here, is a tremendous feeling. I mean, I can't quantify what it means to me to have been a part of it, and I still feel that I still am a part of it.
Well, you certainly are. Let's talk about the Cubs, for starters. And when you came to WGN, now the Cubs obviously have had a long, successful run on WGN Radio, but back in the early 50s, radio stations shared baseball teams, didn't they? I mean, the Cubs weren't locked into WGN Radio the way they are now.
Dave, it's hard for people these days to imagine, but in the 30s, in the 1930s, the Cubs were broadcast on 5 different stations, and there were no rights charges. If you wonder why this happened, I would have to credit Phil Wrigley, who was the president, chairman of the board of the Wrigley Company, who was a visionary of sorts, and when people came to him and told him, his own aides said, if you allow radio to come in and do the Cubs, whenever you get bad weather, nobody's going to show up at that ballpark. And Mr. Wrigley said, I understand that, but he said, also, I understand that this is going to cultivate tens of thousands of new fans every year. And he said, so let's give it a try. And that's what happened. And WIND, of course, did Cubs baseball for many, many years and had the great Burt Wilson on the play-by-play. And WGN had him, and then they went to WIND, and then they came back to GN in the late 50s, and they've been there ever since. And of course, in the meantime, we had some of the great duos. You know, you had Jack Quinlan with Lou Boudreau. Later, you had Vince, and you had Milo. And you've had so many great people involved with Cubs baseball that, I mean, I think this is part of the fabric of our lives here, and it's great to be a part of it.
Let's talk about some of the individuals with whom you worked, and I think we start with Jack Brickhouse. Of course, you've already mentioned Jack, but a man whose talents extended well beyond sports. I think everybody in Chicago knows that, knows how he covered political conventions and hosted band concerts. But what was it like to be side by side with a guy who really was, I think, seen as Mr. Chicago, and he and Irv Kupson had probably shared that title, but a guy who meant so much to the city and was so visible?
Well, I can't say enough nice things about Jack Brickhouse. Not only did he bring me to Chicago, but he became one of my greatest friends ever. He had enormous talent, and he always felt that there was enough out there for everyone. So he accordingly would give everybody credit. And this meant a lot. Now, Jack could do every sport. One of the big things that got him started was professional wrestling, which he did from Marigold Gardens years ago. But when it came to political conventions, which you alluded to, or sports of any kind, I think, in retrospect, that one of the things that changed the whole picture for WGN Radio Sports and later television was a telegram in 1940, which Bob Elson sent to Jack Brickhouse in Peoria. And the telegram said, in effect, expect a call from WGN Radio regarding an announcing position as a staff announcer and part-time sports assistant. And by the way, the telegram read, if they ask you if you have a thorough knowledge of baseball, tell them that you do. Sincerely, Bob Elson. Now, Jack kept that particular telegram on the wall in his rec room the rest of his life, because this was one of the things that got him here. And he came to Chicago then in 1940, and the rest followed. He came out of Peoria. He later brought Vince Lloyd here in the late 40s. And up to 54. Go ahead, Dave.
How was he able to be the voice of the Cubs and the White Sox at the same time and be such a popular guy to fans of both teams, whereas it seems today you really couldn't have one man broadcasting the games of both teams because there's such a fierce rivalry between Cubs fans and Sox fans, yet Jack seemed to bridge that gap.
Jack did bridge the gap, and I tell you why. Because as I later was to give some notes to Stanton Cook when he gave a beautiful tribute to Jack when he retired, and this was at the Chicago Press Club, And the note that I gave to Stanton was that Jack looked at the world through rose-colored glasses. And in his own mind, it's conceivable to think that he never had seen the Cubs lose a game or the White Sox lose a game. Because to Jack, everything was a sunny side of life. And this carried over into his broadcasting and into his dealing with everybody. I used to have people come up to me and say, you know, I got to tell you something. I was out of town, and I ran into Mr. Brickhouse in a hotel lobby, and I never had met him, and of course I've heard of him, and I went up to him, and I said, he probably took you in the coffee shop, bought you a cup of coffee, didn't he? How'd you know that? I said, because this is Jack. And I said, he doesn't care what your status is in life. He treats everybody beautifully. And I said, this is his personality, and this is why he was able to get along with all the people from the Cubs and from the White Sox, and nobody ever really thought of it. He was just identified with them all.
I remember in the book, Thanks for Listening, which I believe you authored with Jack and right. Ed Coletti, there's an anecdote about an appearance on Cup Show in which Jack debated Howard Cosell. If you were to think of two broadcasters who had absolutely opposing styles, it would be Jack and Howard. And Jack didn't seem to make any apologies about his style of broadcasting, which was very much accentuate the positive and let's overlook the bad stuff.
That's exactly right. That's what he did, and he and Howard really went to it that night. But and I mean, Howard made his points and felt that broadcasters would go straight down the middle of the road and never lean towards the home team and that sort of thing. But Jack did not believe that, and I don't think any of the rest of us did either.
When you look at the broadcasters with whom you've worked here, there is a school of thought that there are a lot of guys who've been on the air in Chicago who, in other cities, the act might not have worked, that Chicagoans like their announcers to be rooting for their teams, whereas in other cities, people like more of a down-the-middle approach. Do you agree with that, or do you think there's something to that, that there is a Chicago school of broadcasting that kind of takes that hometown approach?
I think there is, and I think it has worked well. And I said, I don't think we can deny that there are those who would rather not have that. But we have found over the years, from the hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail we used to get from people, that they liked our broadcasters to be Cubs fans, as it were, or White Sox fans, as it were, and do it. So you can argue either way.
I think a lot of Cubs fans know Jack from his days doing the Cubs on WGN television, but let's talk about his relationship with WGN Radio, because when I first worked at WGN Radio, Jack was a very visible part of the radio station. He was hosting Sports Central every evening at 6:30. He was doing pre- and post-game features for our Bears broadcast. In fact, he had only recently given up the Bears play-by-play job. Right. What responsibilities did Jack have with the radio station?
He had contract obligations. He would handle contracts. He was involved in the Big Ten. I mean, we did the Big Ten as we're doing now. We always had a piece of the Big Ten. And Jack really had his finger in many pies around the station because everyone knew him and respected him. And there's a lot of deals that were made. You know, maybe they weren't the formalized deals that we know today with the battery of lawyers and all that involved. A lot of things were done just on a handshake. And this followed for years and years here.
Didn't he actually reach an agreement for the, I believe it was the Bulls broadcast rights, and actually signed a deal on a cocktail napkin?
A cocktail napkin. That is correct. That's a long time ago. Your memory is very good.
They don't do deals that way anymore.
No, they don't do deals that way anymore. And, you know, everything has changed. And there was a time, you know, as I inherited a lot of these contract deals and all that, that I would call up a school like on a Big Ten game of the week, call them on Monday and say, we'd like to come in there on Saturday. They always got us in there. Because we kept our word and we paid our rights and we did it. But then as time went along, you had to have contracts.
How was Jack able to do a Cubs game in the afternoon, and he would go over and do a radio sportscast in the evening, a WGN radio, show up on the WGN TV news, and then turn around and do that 10:55 sports special on WGN radio, all in the span of, what, less than 12 hours?
And thought nothing of it. We used to tell people, all of us, that we work days, nights, holidays, and weekends. Never looked at the clock as far as what time you're going home type of deal. Never worried about how much vacation time we got. We were so enamored to be part of this company and to do what we were doing. And we used to talk among ourselves and we would speculate that most other men in particular wished they were where we were at that point. So we didn't, Jack got around. And I mean, a lot of times the calls were close. And I remember all the years we were doing, especially when you got into August and September, and we had the Bears were starting, and we had the preseason games, and you had the Cubs going, or you had the Sox going on an out-of-town game, and then you had the Big Ten season was starting, and it was a wild time, but somehow we survived all that, and I can say with pardonable pride, too, speaking of Jack, that I remember well the day that he came to me and said he had just gotten a call from New York that he'd been voted into the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And he said, you've done everything for me over the years. He said, could I ask you one more big favor? And I said, of course. He said, would you write my speech? And I said, it'd be an honor. Write your speech, Jack. So I took two or three days and came back to him in his office one day and I said, why don't you sit down and let me read you your speech as I envision it? I said, for starters, it only takes 3 minutes. He said, 3 minutes? Are you kidding? At Cooperstown? I said, Jack, the other people there today, you know, Brooks Robinson, Juan Marichal, Walter Alston's family, may rest in peace, was gone already. And I said, those people will stand up in that hot sun for an hour thanking everyone in creation who got them to this point. If you do that, you'll be here for 3 days in Cooperstown. I said, I have one line that covers that. I said, the line is, countless people have brought me to this pinnacle. You know who you are, and you have my undying gratitude. He said, boy, that's great. So in any case, he sits down, I read him the speech. And I had, you know, I started out with, I feel today like a man 60 feet, 6 inches tall, which is the distance from the mound to home plate, and he really liked that. And I had the line in there about in my dreams, in the fantasy of my dreams, I've imagined that I would one day broadcast an all-Chicago World Series, the Cubs against the Sox, a series that would go 7 games, with the 7th game going into extra innings and then being suspended because of darkness at Wrigley Field. And I had the line, the planes, the trains, the cabs, the buses, they've carried me millions of miles through the years to get me where I most wanted to be, the ball game. I said, there are those who said that even if I never got to Cooperstown, my suitcase probably would. And fortunately, we've arrived together. Now, the thing I always remember, Dave, is that when that speech was over, and we were all sitting there in watching Jack give his speech, he comes off that platform, and some of those old-time writers came up and slapped him on the back and said, I remember Dick Young and some of those people from New York, said, that may be the best single speech ever delivered at Cooperstown. And Jack said, go tell Jack Rosenberg, because he's the one who wrote it. Now, how many people will you get that would do that? And you see, all these years have gone by. Jack is gone. May he rest in peace. But I still remember, and I've told that story countless times. And so he was really a unique person in so many ways.
We're speaking with Jack Rosenberg, longtime sports editor of WGN. I'm Dave Edit. Let's talk about some of the others. Vince Lloyd, another protege of Jack Brickhouse, and another guy who for years was known as the voice of the Cubs, but also held a number of jobs around here.
Vince Lloyd was, like Jack, had a tremendous set of pipes. He just had a great resonant sound on the air, fantastic personality, was born and reared in South Dakota, of Lebanese descent. And Jack used to say when Vince was doing television with him, and I would sit on one side of Jack and Vince was on the other, Jack would always tell people, with me being of the Jewish faith and Vince being Lebanese, Jack would say it was tantamount to him sitting on the Gaza Strip. And that went on for years. But I have to tell you something. Vince Lloyd became, to me, just like Jack, the three of us were like brothers. And we went through all the broadcasting wars together. And I think, as I look back now, Vince also belongs in the Hall of Fame. And he's certainly in my Hall of Fame. And I think if you talk to anybody, you'll find that he is probably as highly regarded as any broadcaster ever.
Tell us about the interview with President Kennedy on opening day in Washington. We have a picture of it right here in the hallway at WGN Radio.
Part of the archives. We were privileged to do that. That was the first time in broadcast history that a station was able to do the President of the United States. And Vince did the interview standing in front of the box seat area with all those Secret Service people around. Vince had his cigar, which was legendary too, but Vince wasn't quite sure what to do with his cigar, and he was tapping his ashes and all. But the President was very kind about answering Vince, and Jack was upstairs in the booth by then, and he was doing a play-by-play of what Vince was doing down there in the field. And it was, a kick to see a great time, and really a great time in American and in sports history for us.
Yeah. You were here when Lou Boudreau joined the Cubs. Well, first of all, he was part of the coaching staff, part of the College of Coaches, correct, for
right.
the Cubs?
Right.
And left the broadcast booth to coach and then went back to radio. How did that work?
Well, that's when Charlie Grimm was managing, and Boudreau was on the field, and Charlie's time had just about run out on him as a manager, so they brought him upstairs and switched Boudreau down there. And the thing about Boudreaux you want to remember is that, here again, Jack Brickhouse being involved, he wanted to come in as a broadcaster, and Jack gets a hold of me and he said, can you type out a series of situations that come up in a ball game? And he says, I'm going to use those with Boudreaux, and we're going to see how he reacts. Now, this was an audition tape. And so I pose a bunch of hypothetical deals, and Jack gets Boudreaux in there. Well, Boudreaux was beautiful, even though we always used to say that he'd missed a couple English classes at the University of Illinois and all, but he was beautiful. And he took to it right away and was hired immediately and started with the booth and then was a manager and then came back to the booth. And he and Vince worked together for many, many years. And Boudreaux was always one of my favorites. He was something else.
They were kind of a unique team, weren't they, Jack? Because, I mean, they were together for so long, and people really associated Vince and Lou as the radio voices of the Cubs. But Lou, I'll go back through tapes we have in our archives here and listen to Lou doing the sideline interviews from the Blackhawks and doing color on Big Ten football games.
He did everything. He did everything, and he also spent a certain amount of time at racetracks. He knew the racing industry well. And Boudreaux was a guy who never bothered about learning people's names. He just called everybody Good Kid. And as the years went by, of course, we all called him Good Kid, and that's the way he was known, because he figured that was a lot easier than trying to remember somebody's name. But he had an insight into anything involving sports, and of course he had been one of the real great shortstops, you know that, and went to Cooperstown, and here again our lives were entwined because all of us went to Cooperstown with him and watched him get inducted into the Hall of Fame. And as a broadcaster, he was great. He was colorful, and I think he became part of people's families who were listening to the games, much as Ron Santo has done in later years, where just part of the family. Just they're comfortable, and if he says it, it's great, that type of deal.
I had the pleasure of knowing and working with Jack and knowing Vince and Lou. I never met Jack Quinlan, but I hear so much about him and his great talents. For those who aren't familiar with Jack Quinlan, never got the chance to hear him, tell us a little about him, and there's a feeling that his star was just starting to rise at the time of his tragic death.
Jack Quinlan, as far as voice quality, strictly voice, which in theory what broadcasting is all about, may have had the best voice of them all. There is no telling what he would have done. And not only that, he was impeccable in preparation for any assignment that he had. I remember in particular, he did the Big Ten games with us for some seasons. And his spotting board had so many notes on there that it was almost like he was writing a book about that particular game. And Jack was just a fabulous talent who had everything going for him and was in spring training in 1965. And had played around the golf down there after practice, and ran into the back of a semi and was killed at age 38. And that was a tragic blow to the, not only to the sports department, but, you know, mainly to his family and all of us who knew him and loved him, because I'd been to his wedding. I went all the way back with Jack. He was another one out of Peoria. And he came here later after GN got the Cubs rights from WIND. And then Jack came over to GN and was just getting a great start here when he died.
I want to talk a little bit about the relationship, as you've seen it, between the broadcasters and the players and the managers. And maybe starting with the 1969 Cubs, because there seems to still be a special bond between the city and that team, and specifically Ernie, Billy, and of course our own Ron Santo. What is it about that group that to this day still makes them such a part of the fabric of this city and its relationship with the Cubs?
Because they gave of themselves. In those days, someone charging for an autograph would have been preposterous. If you would bring any of those people, they would spend hours and hours and hours during the course of a season by the railing out there, by the brick wall, leaning over and signing and signing and smiling and going to the parking lot after games and signing some more and smiling and talking. And, I mean, this was an era which I am very sorry to see that it has passed. We will never see it again in our time because things have changed with endorsements and autographs and some of the stories I see now are appalling to me. But yeah, Ron and Ernie and Billy and Jim Hickman and you know all the guys from that 69 team, they're going to be, you know, even in defeat, because, I mean, I still have stark recollections of September that year when everything went the wrong way and the Mets came on. But those guys will never be forgotten in this city. I mean, they're just, they are, like, as you say, part of the fabric and but that's the main reason that they took the time. And I think this was inherent. I don't think anybody, there are certain things that you do not learn in books. You cannot buy. College doesn't teach this. This part of this is in your genes. And I think that those people are very good examples of that.
What was it like for you guys working day-to-day with the Cubs? That was finally going to be the year. And I remember last year when the Marlins beat the Cubs, how devastated everybody around this radio station was because there were such, the expectations had grown higher and higher, and then it came to a crash again. But in 1969, where suddenly here was this team on the brink of a pennant and going to the World Series, and suddenly it all fell apart. As individuals and as people who worked closely with the Cubs, what was that like for you?
It was crushing. We were almost like members of that team. And, I mean, we looked upon it that way. It was always we. It was never they. Or, you know, they won or they lost. No, it was we won or we lost. And I think it was a different era completely where you got the feeling that you were rising and falling and you were getting the base hits and you were making the plays at third or at short and you were coming out of the bullpen or whatever. When they lost it, we thought that we would never, ever get over it. But I was telling Pat Hughes last fall, after the Cubs had lost out, and I called him to congratulate him on a fantastic season of broadcasting on GN Radio. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a throwback to the great people we're talking about here, Pat Hughes. And we talked at length, and he said he was really down, and it was going to take him a long time to get over it. And I says, Pat, let me tell you something. As somebody who's been around the block many, many times, I said, at your age, your tender age, I said, you will once again see the 1908s and the 1945s in your lifetime. You're going to see a lot of them because the Cubs are building in that direction. But I said, as you get to be my age, you find out that baseball, after all, is still fun and games. And if things are okay at your home with your family and your dear wife, and the health is good, and your kids are doing okay in school, and your grandchildren are healthy, and things like that, I said, you find out that maybe, just maybe, there's things that transcend the outcome of a baseball season. He said, you're a pretty smart guy. And we hung up, and that was the call.
Tell us about Leo DeRocher and his relationship, and from what I gather, sometimes a little stormy with some of the broadcasters and with Jack. I mean, they had a pretty well-known feud, did they not?
They did have, and my personal dealing with Leo was outstanding. I thought he was a great manager and a great guy to deal with, and very colorful. The general feeling was that Leo was the biggest in his field, and Jack was the biggest in his field, and there the twain shall meet. And it could have been that when Leo was remarried, he did not invite Jack to his wedding. That sort of rankled Jack, things like that. I think Leo felt that he could never quite catch up with Jack in popularity. I remember Leo used to like to needle me about my great friendship with Jack. One day in particular, in the clubhouse, in the coach's room, Leo gets me on the side, trying to stoke me up. And he says, Jack, I want to tell you something. He said, I know you're a Brickhouse guy, but he says, I want you to know that Brickhouse can't carry Vince Scully's shoes. I said, Leo, how can you say that? I said, Vince Scully is our buddy. I said, we all started out in baseball together in the major leagues. And I said, he came out of Brooklyn. And I said, he's a super guy. And I said, the thing you're forgetting is that Jack and Vince as well, Vince Scully, have spent so much time helping young broadcasters, would-be broadcasters, who want to make an impact in the field. And he said, and I said, Jack really is behind this team and behind you, and I don't know why you keep picking little fights with him. And he says, let me tell you something. He said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, let's just say, for instance, that I'm walking down the street, and I don't have any money, and I run into Brickhouse. And I say, Jack, you know, I'm up against it. Can you let me have $50 for a couple weeks? And he says, Brickhouse tells me, hey, you know what? I got to get going. I'll see you later. He said, now, he said, I'm walking down the street again, and I see you. And he said, I tell you the same story. And he says, if you have $50, which I don't even know if you do, but he said, if you do, he said, no question, you give it to me. He said, now I will tell you this. You can have anything in this clubhouse you want. And he turned around and walked out. And I still remember Pete Reeser, who was coaching then, said to me, you just got praise from Caesar. He said, I have never heard that from anybody. I said, well, it's too bad it was in that context where he's putting Jack. I know he's just needling me about Jack, but that was it. So DeRocher was he was so colorful, Dave, that I used to just enjoy sitting in his office there and hearing his stories. And I know that he fabricated a few of them, but he told us a story once. I remember that Pee Wee Reese and I were in his office, just the two of us. And Leo started talking about his dear friend, Frank Sinatra. And he liked to bring up Frank's name, and they were friends. And Leo said, you know, I haven't told this story to too many, but he said, years and years ago, he said, I was managing the New York Giants, and he said, I get a call from Sinatra. And Sinatra said, I understand that Uncle Sam says you owe a little bit in back taxes. Is that true? And Leo said, that is true, but he said, I don't really think I owe him, but they say I do. And Frank said, according to Leo, how much do they say you owe? And Leo says, $50,000. Now, you're talking many years ago. He said, $50,000. Frank said, well, let me see what I can do about it. So, according to Leo, the next day, he gets a knock on the door, his apartment. And he opened the door. There's two people there. They say, Mr. DeRocher? He says, yeah. They said, Mr. Sinatra said to give you this package. And Leo thanks him, goes in, opens up the package. There's $50,000 in cash in there. I said, you ever pay him back? He said, every nickel. He said, it took me 3 years, but I paid him back every nickel. And he says, that's why I would do anything for Frank Sinatra.
Wow. The relationship with the Bears. You were there. We talked about the 69 Cubs. How about the 63 Bears? That's another team which I think people remember very fondly.
63 Bears were unbelievable. We'd been used to so many losing seasons that to have a team come on like that was really something. George Allen was one of the assistants, and of course George Halas, to this day, was I had to say he was one of my all-time favorite people. If you were around him, you couldn't help but have respect for him. And there were some players who used to say, he threw around, quarters like manhole covers, that sort of thing. But what they didn't realize was that the coach had helped so many people and set up their business lives for later. I mean, the Sid Luckmans and all the rest that he helped, that he was really something. But the 63 Bears came on, and I remember they had the big game against Detroit here that you still have a tape of Jack calling, where Davey Witzel made the interception mm-hmm. against the Lions, and that helped put them over the hump. 63 was also the year that President Kennedy was assassinated in November on the 22nd, and I remember Ward Quall, the president of the company then, called all of us in, running the departments, and wanted to know, what are your plans for this weekend? Because this happened on a Friday. And when he got around to sports, he said, what do we have in sports? And I said, we have Illinois at Michigan State. I said, that's the game that's going to decide the Rose Bowl. And he said, how do you feel about doing the game? And I said, my personal opinion is that this country is in no mood for football on this weekend with what has happened. He said, did you sign the contract? I said, yes, I did. He said, then I will make the decision. He said, we should put the onus on the Big Ten and not on us. He said, we have signed contract, you've signed it. He said, let's leave it up to them. So, Jack Brickhouse, Jack Quinlan, and I take off for O'Hare Field in a driving rainstorm. We get to the airport, and they have canceled the flight to Lansing. I, in those days, knew all the schedules. I knew there was a train leaving Union Station at 6 o'clock in the evening. So we then jumped in a cab, went down there, took the train. I still remember as if it were yesterday that we sat in that dining car all the way to Lansing. You could have literally heard a pin drop. No one was saying a word. And we went to the hotel the next morning. The Big Ten called me in my hotel room early in the morning, said, we've decided to postpone the game. We'll play it Thanksgiving Day, the following Thursday. And that was it. I called Ward Quall at home to tell him, and he said, how do you feel about the Bears getting back to the 63 Bears? How do you feel about the Bears in Pittsburgh? I said, I feel the same way. He said, let's pull out. He said, let's skip that broadcast tomorrow. That was the only game in 24 years, Bears games, we didn't do on GN Radio. And as it turns out, that was Mike Ditka's greatest game, where he ran
signature run
with you know, knocking tacklers off his back and all that. But I remember when we got back to O'Hare from Lansing, we went on to the Bears charter and wished them all good luck in Pittsburgh, and they won. And that was a game that, as it turns out, put them over the top, and they played the Giants, of course, for the championship, and that was a 14-10 game, as you well know. And Billy Wade scored both touchdowns on sneaks, and it was great. Sid Luckman wound up giving his share of the playoff money, which I believe, to show you how things have changed, was $6,000, and he turned his back to the players. That's the kind of guy Sid Luckman was. So that was 63, and Jack and Cup were there, and you know all about that.
They had kind of a unique relationship, too, didn't they, in the radio booth?
It was great. Irv Cupson, it was a joy to work with, and many times Cup would leave for a game at 5 in the morning to meet us on the road somewhere. He would come and meet me in the coffee shop somewhere, have his breakfast, wouldn't even check into didn't need a room because he was only going to be there for half an hour or something. He'd come up in my room immediately, would get on the phone and call some item in for his column for the next morning. He worked around the clock, and was just a tremendous guy. And when he started doing the Bears with Jack, the first year they were doing a game on the coast, and Cup was to handle the halftime show. So Jack said, do you need any help lining up some interviews? And Cup said, no, I think I'll be okay. And just before the half, the door of the booth opened, in walked Carmen Basilio, who had just won the middleweight championship, boxing, Bob Hope, and Harry Truman, who already was out of the White House. And once Jack saw those three, he realized that Irv Cupps in it didn't need any help lining up halftime guests.
Jack, as we wrap things up, and I appreciate your spending some time reflecting on some of this, how do you feel about the way sports is covered now? I mean, we have ESPN, we have sports talk radio 24 hours, we have every place you turn, you see highlights of every game played. And there, at the same time, there seems to have been a cooling in the relationship between the players and the people covering them from the way it was back in your days traveling with the Cubs and the Bears. Do you think we've progressed, or do you think we've taken a step back?
I think we progress, because the little animosities at all will come and go. They always do. You've always had a handful of those, no matter what. I know that the Cubs are experiencing some of that now, which I really think is absurd, because Chip and Steve Stone certainly benefit when the Cubs do well, and they are Cubs fans in their own right, too, but they have to call them as they see them. And if there's a few people who get their noses out of joint, I think it's only natural for that to happen when you have all this excitement going on. And I think that will pass. The technological advances are incredible. When I think of what we did and what you people do now, I mean, it's altogether different. And I remember being on with Dave Kaplan and Tom Waddell just a few weeks ago. They were kind enough to have me on. And they were saying then that they'd just gotten some sort of a letter or whatever from Iraq. And, I mean, you know, things have changed, and hopefully they'll change for the better. Main thing we need in this world is peace. And if we can get peace, the sports is going to take care of itself.
I think that's a great note on which to end. Jack Rosenberg, thanks for all you've done for WGN Radio, and it's been great spending some time reflecting with you. Thanks very much.
It's a privilege being here.